Our table wasn't as good as last time. I spotted Professor Dallas at her usual table, alone this time. She didn't seem to mind. The stone lid was carved in a crouching jaguar with a necklace of human skulls. The High Priest Pinotl came onto the stage. He was dressed only in that skirt thing, a mochlatl, that left the legs and most of the hips bare. I'd asked Dallas what the skirt was. His face was painted black with a stripe of white across the eyes and nose. His long black hair had been formed into individual strands curling at the ends. He wore a white crown, and it took me a second to realize it was made of bones. The stage lights flickered over the white bones, making them shimmer and almost bleed white color when he moved his head. Finger bones had been restrung and formed a fan above the main band, reminiscent of the feathers I'd seen him wearing the first time. His ear spools of gold had been replaced by bones. He looked totally different from the first time, and yet the moment he stepped out on stage, I knew it was him. No one else had had that aura of command. I leaned into Ramirez.
You wearing a cross?
Yes, why?
His voice can be a little overwhelming without a little help.
He's human, isn't he?
He's her human servant.
Ramirez turned his face full into mine, and we were too close. I had to move back to keep from bumping noses.
What?
Did he really not know what a human servant was for a vampire? I didn't have time to give him a preternatural lesson, and this wasn't the place anyway. Far too many listening ears. I shook my head.
I'll explain later.
Two very Aztec-looking bouncers came on stage and lifted the lid of the coffin off. They moved to one side with it, and the way they shuffled, muscles in their arms and back working, it looked heavy. There was a cloth-draped body in the coffin. I didn't know for certain that it was a body, but it was shaped like a body. There just aren't that many things that are body-shaped. Pinotl began to speak.
Those of you who have been with us before know what it is to make sacrifice to the gods. You have shared in that glory, taken the offering into yourselves. But only the bravest, the most virtuous, are fit sacrifices. There are those that are not fit to feed the gods with their lives, but they too may serve.
He drew the cloth off in one large movement, sending the black and sequin-draped cloth spreading wide like a fisherman's net. As that glittering cloth fell to the stage, the contents of the coffin were revealed. Gasps, screams spread through the audience like ripples in a pool. There was a body in the coffin. It was dried and wizened, as if the body had been buried in the desert and had mummified naturally. No artificial preservatives. The spotlight on the coffin seemed very bright, harsh. It showed every line in the dried skin. The skeletal shadow of bones underneath was painfully clear. We were only three rows back, close enough to see more detail than I cared to see. At least this time they wouldn't be cutting anyone up. I really wasn't in the mood to see inside anyone's chest tonight. I was searching the crowd, trying to see if she was coming, or if we were about to be surrounded by were-jaguars. I turned and looked. The dead mummy's eyes were open. I looked at Edward. He answered the question without me having to say it.
Its eyes just opened. Nobody touched it.
I stared at that skull trapped under dry parchment skin. The eyes were full of something dry and brown. There was no life to the eyes, but they were open. The mouth began to open slowly, as if the mouth were on a stiff hinge. As the mouth opened, a sound came out of it, a sigh that grew into a scream that echoed through the room, reverberated off the ceiling, the walls, the inside of my head.
"It's a trick, right?" Ramirez said. I just shook my head. It wasn't a trick.
Dear God, it wasn't a trick. I looked at Edward and he just shook his head. He'd never seen this particular act either. The scream died, and there was a silence so thick you could have dropped a pin and heard it bounce. I think everyone was holding their breath, straining to hear. To hear what, I didn't know, but I was doing it too. I think I was trying to hear it breathe. I studied that skeletal chest, but it didn't rise and fall. It didn't move. I said a silent prayer of thanks.
This one's energy went to feed our dark goddess, but she is merciful. What was taken shall be given back. This is Mika Pedlakali, the box of death. I am Nextepua. In legend, I was the husband of Mika Pedlakali, and I am still married to death. Death runs through my veins. My blood tastes of death. Only the blood of one consecrated to death will free this one of torment.
I realized that Pinotl's voice was just a voice. A good voice,
like a good stage actor, but nothing more. Either he wasn't trying to bespell the audience, or I wasn't as susceptible tonight. The only change that I knew for certain was the marks. They were wide open now. I'd been told by my teacher and by Leonora Evans that the marks made me more vulnerable to psychic attack, but maybe on some things having a direct link to the boys helped me. Whatever it was, his voice didn't move me tonight. Great. Pinodal drew an obsidian blade from behind his back. He'd probably been carrying it the way Edward and I were carrying guns, at the small of his back. He held his arm over the open coffin, over that gaping mouth. He drew the blade across his skin. It wasn't clear to the audience what he'd done. It would have been much better theater for Pinodal to slash his arm where the audience could see that first crimson slash. For him to hide it, there had to be some ritual significance, some importance to those first drops of blood going into the corpse's mouth. He dripped blood on the top of the thing's skull, dabbed it in the middle of that skull forehead, touched it to the throat, the chest, the stomach, the abdomen. He went down the line of chakras, energy points, of the body. I'd never believed in chakras until this year, when I'd found they were real, and they seemed to work. I hated all this New Age stuff. I hated it worse when it worked. Of course, this wasn't New Age stuff. This was very old stuff. With each touch of blood to that dried thing, I felt magic. Each drop of blood made it grow, until the air hummed with it and my skin crept in waves of goosebumps. Edward sat unmoved, but Ramirez was rubbing his arms, chasing goosebumps. What's happening? He was at the very least a sensitive. I guess I couldn't possibly be attracted to a totally normal human being. I whispered, "Magic." He looked at me, eyes showing too much white. What kind? I shook my head. That I didn't know. I had a few clues, but I really had never seen anything like it. Not exactly. Pinodal walked around the coffin in a counterclockwise motion, bleeding arm and bloody knife held apart, palm up while he chanted. The power built and built in the air like close thunder until my throat closed with it and I was having trouble breathing. Pinodal came back to the front of the coffin where he'd begun. He made some kind of sign with his hands, then flung a spray of blood onto the body and began to back slowly away. The lights dimmed until the only light was the harsh white light on the thing in the coffin. The power had built to a screaming pitch. My skin was trying to crawl off my body and hide. The air was too thick to breathe, as if it had grown more solid, thick with magic. Something was happening to the body. The power broke like a cloud bursting with rain, and that invisible rain broke over the body, over the room, over us all. But the focus was that dried thing. The skin began to move, to twitch. It filled out as if water flowed beneath it. Something liquid moved under that dry, wasted skin, and where it flowed, the skin began to stretch. It was like watching one of those blow-up dolls fill up. Flesh. Flesh was flowing under the skin. It plumped like some obscene kind of dough. The body, the man, began to thrash and twist against the sides of the coffin. The chest finally rose, drawing in a great draft of air, as if he were struggling back from the dead. It was like the opposite of that death rattle where the breath flows away for the last time. Of course, that was exactly what it was. Life returning. The last breath being drawn back in. When he had air to breathe, he began to scream. One long, ragged shriek after another. As fast as his healing chest could bring in the air, he screamed. The dry hair on his head turned curly, brown, and soft. His skin was tanned and young, smooth and flawless. He'd been under 30 when he went into the coffin. Who knew how long he'd been in there? Even after he looked human again, he kept shrieking, as if he had been waiting a very long time to scream. A woman near the front screamed and took off running for the door. The vampires had moved up quietly through the tables. I hadn't sensed them over the suffocating flow of magic and the sheer horror of the show. Careless of me. A vampire caught the running woman, held her, and she grew instantly still. He led her quietly back to her table, to the man that was standing, wondering what he should do. The vampires moved through the crowd, touching someone here, stroking a hand there, soothing, soothing, telling the great lie. It was safe. It was peaceful. It was good. Ramirez watched the vampires. He turned to me. What are they doing? Soothing the crowd so they don't all bolt for the exits. They aren't allowed to use one-on-one hypnosis. I don't think it's personal. More like crowd hypnosis. I looked back to the stage and found the man had collapsed onto the stage, pushing his way out of the coffin as soon as he got the strength. He was trying to crawl away. Pinotl appeared in the growing circle of light. The man screamed and held his hands up in front of his face as if to ward off a blow. Pinotl spoke, and he didn't yell, so he must have been using a microphone of some kind.
"Have you learned humility?"
he asked. The man whimpered and hid his face.
"Have you learned obedience?"
The man nodded his head over and over, still hiding his face. He started to cry, great sobs that made his shoulders shake. 3 rows out and I could hear him sobbing. Pinotl motioned and the 2 bouncers that had opened the coffin walked on stage. They lifted the weeping man up, carrying him between them. His legs didn't seem to move yet, so they carried him, with an arm on either of their shoulders, his feet dangling off the floor. He wasn't a small man, and again you got that sense of how strong the 2 men were. They were human, too, not were-anything. 2 were-jaguars walked on stage in their spotted skin clothes, and between them they held another man. No, not a man. A were-animal. It was Seth. He'd been stripped down to a G-string that left very little to the imagination. His long yellow hair was unbound, streaked with light and color. He didn't struggle as they brought him up on stage. The jaguar men had him kneel in front of Pinotl.
"Do you acknowledge our dark goddess as your one and true mistress?"
Seth nodded. "I do." His voice didn't have the resonance of the other man's, and I doubted that the people in the back could hear him.
"She has given you life, Seth, and it is right that she should ask you give that life back to her."
"Yes," Seth said.
"Then I will be her hand, and take that which is hers."
He cradled Seth's face between his hands. It was gentle. The 2 jaguar men let go of Seth and backed away. But they stayed close, almost as if afraid that he might run. But his face was turned upward with a near beatific expression on it, as if this were wonderful. He'd been so afraid of being tortured by Itzpapalotl's 4 sisters weird, and yet now he seemed at peace with what they were about to do. I thought I knew, and I hoped I was wrong. Just once when I expect something truly hideous is about to happen, I'd like to be wrong. It would be a nice change. It wasn't flashy. There was no fire or light or even a shimmer of heat. Lines appeared on Seth's 20-something skin. The muscles under his skin began to shrink as though he had a wasting disease, but what should have taken months was happening in seconds. No matter how willing the sacrifice, it can still hurt. Seth started screaming as fast as he could draw breath. His lungs were working better than the other man's, and he drew breath so fast it was like 1 continuous shriek. The skin darkened as it drew in and in like something were sucking him dry. It was like watching a balloon shrivel. Except there was muscle, and when the muscle vanished, there was bone, and finally there was nothing but dried skin over bones, and still he screamed. I've become something of a connoisseur of screams over the years, and I've heard some good ones. Some of them have even been mine, but I'd never heard anything like this. The sound stopped being human, and became like the high-pitched sound of some wounded animal, but underneath it all you knew at a level that you couldn't even explain, that it was a person. Finally, there was no more air for screaming, but that dry, empty mouth kept opening and closing, opening and closing. Long after the screaming stopped, that skeletal thing was still writhing, still flinging its head from side to side. Pinotl kept his hands pressed to Seth's face. He held him, and it looked gentle the whole time, but he had to be gripping with all the strength he had because he never lost his grip. While the flesh of that handsome face shriveled and died between his hands, Pinotl never moved. And through it all, Seth never once raised his hands up to save himself. He struggled because he couldn't not struggle, it hurt that much, but he never raised his hands against the other man. A willing sacrifice. A fit sacrifice. My throat was tight, and something burned behind my eyes. I just wanted it over now. I just wanted it to stop. But it didn't stop. The skeletal thing that had been Seth kept twitching, opening and closing its mouth, as if trying to talk. Pinotl looked up, breaking eye contact with Seth for a heartbeat. The 2 jaguar men that had escorted him onto the stage came into the light. One of them held a silver needle with black thread on it. The other held a pale green ball, tiny, the size of a marble, maybe. If I'd been sitting much farther out, I'd have never known what it was. Jade, I think. A jade ball. They placed it in that gaping mouth, and the mouth closed. The other jaguar began to sew his mouth shut, driving the silver needle through the dry, lipless flesh, tugging it tight. I looked at the table, too, resting my forehead on the cool stone of the table. I would not faint. I never fainted. But I had a sudden flash of the creature that Nicky Bacco had created out of the werewolves. Some of them had had their mouths sewn shut. I'd never seen a power like this. It was too big a coincidence that two people in one town could do it and not be connected. Ramirez touched my shoulder. I raised my head and shook it. I'm all right. I looked up and they were putting Seth in the coffin. I knew without trying to sense it that he was still in there. Still aware. He could not have understood what he was letting them do to him. He couldn't have. Could he? Pinotl turned to the audience, and his eyes glowed with black fire the way a vampire's do when their power is high. Black flames licked around his eye sockets, and his skin seemed to glow with the power. The thing that Seth had become was covered with the same black glittering cloth that had covered the last body. The jaguar assistants closed the coffin, securing the heavy lid. A collective sigh ran through the audience, as if they were all relieved that it was covered. I wasn't the only one that didn't want to see it anymore. Itz Papalotl glided on stage. She was wearing the same crimson cloak as before. Pinotl went to one knee in front of her, extending his hands. She put her delicate hands on his strong ones, and I felt the rush of power like the brush of bird's wings. Pinotl stood, holding her hand, and they turned to the audience, and now both of them had eyes of black flame, spreading over their faces like a mask. Soft spotlights filled the darkness of the tables like giant soft fireflies. Each light found one of the vampires. They were pale and wan, hungry. Fasted, maybe, because I wasn't the only one who could tell they hadn't fed. You heard the exclamations through the audience. How pale. How frightening. Oh my God. No, she wanted everyone to see them for what they truly were. She and Pinotl stared off into that soft-lit dark, and again I felt the rush of power, like a chittering flight of birds, brushing across my face, my skin, as if I had no clothes, and the swift passing of feathered things caressed my body. I felt it almost like a series of physical blows, as the power hit each vampire, and their eyes filled with black fire. They became shining things with skin of alabaster, bronze, copper, all glowing, all beautiful with eyes filled with the light of black stars. Then they fell into line and began to sing. A song of praise to her, their dark goddess. Diego, the vampire we'd seen whipped senseless, passed by our table with a leash in his hand. On the end of that leash was a tall, pale-skinned man with curly yellow hair. Was it Cristobal? One of the starved ones? There were no starved ones in line. All of them were glowing and well-fed and filled to bursting with a dark, sweet power like overripe berries before they fall to the ground, when they are poised between the sweetest of ripeness and rotting. Life is often like that, the best balancing on a knife edge with the worst. The vampires left the stage still singing her praises. Pinotl and she walked hand in hand down the steps, and I knew where they were coming, and I didn't want them near me. I could still feel the power as though I were standing in the middle of a cloud of butterflies, and they were beating at my skin with soft wings, beating at me, trying to come inside. They came and stood in front of our table. Her face was smiling, soft as she gazed down at me. The black flames had quieted, but her eyes were still an empty blackness with a flicker of light in their depths. Pinotl's eyes echoed hers like a mirror, but it wasn't black flame. It was the blackness of endless night, and there were stars in her eyes. An endless fall of stars. Edward had my arm. He had turned me to face him. We were both standing, though I didn't remember getting up.
Anita, are you okay?
I had to swallow twice to find my voice. I'm okay, I think. Yeah, I'm okay. But the power was still beating against me like frantic wings, birds crying that they've been shut out in the dark and they want inside to the light and the warmth. How could I leave them crying in the dark when all I had to do was open and they would be safe? Stop it, I said. I turned to face them. They were still smiling, still welcoming. She held her hand out to me, the other still holding Pinotl's hand. I knew if I took that hand that all this power would flow into me, that I could share it with them. It was an offering to share. But at what price? Because there was always a price.
What do you want?
I asked. I wasn't even sure who I was asking.
I want the knowledge of how your triad of power was achieved.
I can tell you that. You don't need to do this.
You know that I cannot tell truth from lie. It is not one of my powers. Touch me, and I will gain the knowledge from you.
The wings were flowing over my skin as if the flying things had found a current of air just above my body. What do I gain?
Think of one question, and if I have the answer, you will draw it from my mind.
Ramirez was standing. He motioned, and I knew without looking that the uniforms were coming this way. I don't know what's happening, but we're not doing it.
Answer one question first, I said. If I can, she said. Who is the red woman's husband?
Her face showed nothing, but her voice was puzzled.
The red woman was another term for blood among the Mexicanas, among the Aztecs. I truly do not know who the red woman's husband would be.
I'd half reached out to her. I didn't really mean to. Three things happened almost together. Ramirez and Edward both grabbed me to pull me back, and its Papalotl grabbed my hand. The wings erupted into a torrent of birds. My body opened, though I knew it didn't, and the winged things, only half-glimpsed, spilled into that opening. The power flowed into me, through me, and out again. I was part of some great circuit, and I felt the connection with every vampire she'd touched. It was as if I flowed through them, and they through me, like water coming together to form something larger. Then I was floating in the soothing dark, and there were stars, distant and glittering. A voice, her voice, came.
Ask one question, and it shall be yours.
I asked, though my mouth never moved. Still, I heard the words. How did Nicky Bacco learn to do what Pinotl did to Seth? With the words came the image of Nicky's creature so clear I could smell the dryness of it, and hear that voice whispering, "Help me." Images then, and they had force to them like things slamming into my body. I saw Itzpapalotl standing on the top of a pyramid temple, surrounded by trees, jungle. I could smell the rich greenness of it, and hear the night call of a monkey, the scream of a jaguar. Pinotl knelt and fed from the bloody wound on her chest. He became her servant, and he gained power. Many powers, and one of them was this. And I understood how he'd taken Seth's essence. More than that, I understood how it was done, and how it was undone. I knew how to unmake Nicky's creature, though what he'd done to them might mean that to bring them back to flesh would kill them. We didn't need Nicky to undo the spell. I could do it. Pinotl could do it. She didn't ask if I understood. She knew when I had it all.
Now for my question.
And before I could say or think, wait, she was inside my head. She drew the memories from me, images, pieces, and I couldn't stop her. She saw Jean-Claude mark me, and she saw Richard, and she saw the three of us calling power on purpose for the first time. She saw that last night when I'd taken the second and third mark to save our lives, all our lives. I was suddenly back in my own skin, standing on one side of the table, still holding her hand. I was gasping, fast and faster, and I knew if I didn't get control I was going to hyperventilate. She released my hand, and all I could do was concentrate on my own breathing. Ramirez was yelling at me, was I all right? Edward had his gun out, pointed at her. She and Pinotl just stood there, peaceful. I could see everything as though I were looking through crystal. The colors seemed darker, more vivid. Things stood out in bold relief, and it wasn't the things I would normally have noticed. The way the band in Edward's hat had a small ridge in it, and I knew where the garret was. When I could finally talk, I said, "It's all right. It's all right. I'm not hurt." I touched Edward's hand, lowering the gun to point at the table. "Chill, okay? I'm all right." "She said it would harm you if we forced you to let go early," Edward said. "It might have," I said. I'd expected to feel badly, drained, tired, but I didn't. I felt energized, exhilarated. I feel great.
"You don't look great," Edward said,
and there was something in his voice that made me look at him. He grabbed my hand and started leading me through the tables towards the door. I tried to slow down and he jerked me with him, pulling me along. "You're hurting my wrist," I said. He pushed through the doors with the gun still naked in his hand, my wrist gripped in his other hand. He hit the lobby doors with his shoulders. I remembered it being darker in the lobby, but it wasn't dark now. It wasn't exactly light, it just wasn't dark. He pushed one of the wall hangings apart, and there was the men's room door. He pushed it open before I could say anything. The urinals stretched empty, and I was grateful. The lights were bright, made me squint. Edward whirled me around to face the mirrors. My eyes were a solid, shining black. There was no pupil, no white, nothing. I looked blind, yet I could see everything, every crack in the wall, the smallest dint on the edge of the mirror. I walked forward, and he let me go. I reached out until I could touch my reflection. I jumped when my fingers met the cool glass, as if I'd expected my hand to keep on going. I stared at my hand, and I could almost see the bones under my skin, the muscles working as I moved my fingers. Underneath that, I could see the flow of blood under my skin. I turned and looked at Edward. I looked at him slowly, and I could see the slight difference in the pants leg where the hilt of the knife was sticking out of his boot. There was the faintest line where the second knife was strapped to his thigh, and he could reach through his pants pocket and touch the hilt. There was a bulge in his other pocket, small, but I knew it was a gun. A Derringer, probably. But that last bit of knowledge was my knowledge. The rest was this extraordinary vision. It was like some fantasy spell of true seeing. If this was how all vampires saw the world, then I should just stop trying to hide weapons. But I'd fooled vampires before, master-level vampires. So this was how she saw the world, but not necessarily how they all saw the world.
Say something, Anita.
I wish you could see what I'm seeing.
I don't want to, he said.
The garret is in the band of your hat. You've got a knife and a sheath in your right boot, and a knife on your left thigh. You reach the hilt through your pants pocket. There's a Derringer in your right pants pocket. He paled, and I saw it. I saw the pulse in his throat beat faster. I could see the small changes in his body as the fear rushed through it. No wonder she'd been able to read me so easily. But it should have worked like a lie detector for her. That's what other vamps and were-animals pick up on, the minute changes we all make when we lie. Even the smell changes, so Richard said. So why couldn't she tell if someone were lying? The answer came in a wave of clarity that you usually have to meditate to have. She couldn't read things she didn't have inside herself. She wasn't a goddess. She was a vampire, not like any vampire I'd ever known before, but that's what she was. Yet she believed she was Itzpapalotl, the living personification of the sacrificial knife, the obsidian blade. She was lying to herself, and thus she couldn't see a lie in someone else. She didn't understand what truth was, so she couldn't recognize that either. She was fooling herself on a cosmic scale, and it weakened her. But I wasn't going to march out there and point out the error of her ways. She was just a vampire and not a goddess, but I'd had a taste of her power, and I did not want to be on her dirty list. With her power flowing through me like a rising wind, warm and smelling of flowers that I did not recognize, I didn't even want to burst her bubble. I hadn't felt this good in days. I turned back to the mirror, and my eyes were still that spreading blackness. I should have been scared or screaming, but I wasn't scared, and all I could think was, cool.
Shouldn't your eyes go back to normal?
He asked, and again I felt that tightness of fear in him. Eventually, but if we really want answers to our questions, we need to go back and ask her. He gave one quick nod, after you, and I realized that Edward didn't trust me at his back. He thought that she had possessed me. I didn't argue with him. I just walked through the door first and went back to talk to Itzpapalotl. I hoped Ramirez hadn't tried to put handcuffs on her. She wouldn't like that, and what she didn't like, her followers didn't like, and there were 102 vampires. I had no idea how many were-jaguars she had. This was a feeding not meant for them. But it was a small army, and Ramirez hadn't brought that much backup. Chapter 52 Ramirez hadn't put cuffs on anyone, but he had called for more backup. There were 4 more uniforms in the room, and about 20 were-jaguars. The audience was watching it all as if it were part of the show. I guess if they could sit through what had been done to Seth, they could sit through a little police action. I was ahead of Edward as we came into the room. He fell a step behind me, the way we often did when one of us was going to be in charge of the next few minutes. Maybe my eyes were glowing black pits, but Edward still trusted me to calm the situation. Good to know. The were-jaguars were moving through the tables, trying to flank the cops. The uniforms had their hands on their guns. The holsters were unbuckled. It wasn't going to take much to get a gun drawn and the shit to hit the fan. Be a shame to push this big a button when the vampires weren't trying to hurt anybody. One of the jaguars was moving again, trying to close the circle around the police. I touched his arm. His power trembled over my hand, and it was more than just my own power or the marks that flared and answered that rush. He looked down at me and saw the eyes or felt her power, whatever it was, when I said, "Back up. Go stand with the others." He did it. Progress. Now if only the police would be as reasonable. I turned to the police and started walking towards them. One of the new uniforms said, "Shit!" Hand on gun, other hand out like a traffic stop. "Don't come any closer!" "Ramirez," I said, and made sure my voice carried. "It's okay. She's with us," he said.
"But her eyes," the uniform said.
"She's with us. Let her through now." Ramirez's voice was low, but the anger carried. The uniforms parted like a curtain, very careful not to touch me as I went past. I guess I couldn't blame them, though I wanted to. I was finally at the table with Edward behind me and the nervous uniforms beyond him. I faced Itz Papalotl across the table. Pinotl was at her side, but they were no longer holding hands. His eyes were still as black as mine, but hers were normal. Strangely, with the hood pushed back to show that delicate face and those normal-seeming eyes, she looked the most human of the three of us. Ramirez had laid some of the pictures on the table.
"Tell me what this is."
It sounded like a question he'd asked before. She looked at me. "Do you know what it is?" I asked.
"No, I truly do not. It does look like one of our artisans could have made it, but the eyes are stones that came with the Spaniards. I do not recognize all the elements of the symbolism."
"But you recognize some of them," I said.
"Yes.
What do you recognize?"
"The bodies around the base could be the ones you drink."
"You mean like you did with Seth tonight?" She nodded. "What is it holding in its hands?"
"It could be many things, but I think it is the lesser things of the body. The heart is spoken for, as are the bones, and many other parts. But no god feeds on the..."
She frowned, searching for the word.
"Intestines and other viscera."
"That makes sense," I said. I felt Ramirez shift beside me, as if he badly wanted to say, "It does." But he kept quiet because he was a good cop and she was talking to me. Did it really matter why? Not right that second it didn't.
"You saw the creature that..."
It was my turn to hesitate. If the police knew what Nicky had done, it was an automatic death sentence. But frankly, he deserved it. The werewolves that he had sucked dry hadn't been willing sacrifices. And he'd cut them up, knowing they were still alive. He'd cut them up and sewn them into that monster behind the bar. It was one of the worst things I'd come across, and that was saying a lot. I made my decision, and knew that it would eventually cost Nicky his life.
"You saw the creature that Nicky Bacco made?"
She nodded.
"I saw. It is a corruption of a great gift."
"Does his master gain power through it just like you do?"
"Yes, and Nicky Bacco gains power through it, much as Pinotl does. As you have."
"Can he pass that power to others, like maybe a werewolf pack?"
She seemed to think about that, head to one side, then finally nodded.
"It would be possible to share with were-animals, if you had some bond with them of a mystical nature."
"He's Vargamor for the local pack," I said.
"I am not familiar with the word Vargamor."
It was a wolf term.
"It's their witch, their brujo, and they are bound to the pack." "Then certainly he could share the power with them."
"Nicky said he didn't know where this god lay."
"He lies," she said. "You do not gain this power without the touch of your god's hand."
I'd gotten that from the images that had filled me, but I wanted it confirmed.
"Then Nicky should be able to take us to the place where the god is hiding?"
She nodded.
"He knows."
"Do you have a problem with us hunting down and killing a god from your pantheon?"
A look crossed her face that I didn't understand.
"If it is a god, then you cannot kill it. And if you can kill it, then it is not a god. I do not mourn the death of false gods."
It was kind of funny coming from her, but I let it go. It wasn't my job to convince her what she was or what she wasn't.
"Thank you for your help, Itz Papalotl."
She gave me a long look, and I knew what she wanted, but...
"You are indeed a goddess, but I cannot serve two masters," I said.
"His power is lust, and you deny him his power."
I felt the heat rush up my face and wondered what a blush looked like with glowing black eyes. It wasn't what she'd said. It was me knowing what she'd seen in my head. She knew more intimate details than my best friend. Just as I'd shared what she and Pinotl considered a very private and intimate moment of their sharing. Fair is fair, but somehow I didn't think Eats Papalotto blushed. I thought I was just denying him sex. She looked at me the way you'd look at a child that was deliberately misunderstanding a point.
Tell me, Anita, what is the base of my power?
The question surprised me, but I answered it. The time for lying between us was past. Power. You feed off of pure power regardless of the source. She smiled, and that thread of power in me smiled with her, made me feel glowy all over.
Now, what is your master's base of power?
I'd been running from this particular truth for a very long time. Not all master vampires had a secondary power base, another way to draw energy, other than blood or human servants or animals to call. But some did, and Jean-Claude was one of them.
Anita,
she said, as if reminding me that I was supposed to be saying something. Sex. His base of power is sex, I said. Again, she smiled happily at me, and I felt that warm, answering glow. It was good to be truthful. It was good to be smart. It was good to please her. And that, of course, was one of her dangers. If you stayed near her long enough, it might become an end in itself to please her. Even thinking it, I couldn't be afraid of her. Good that I didn't live in Albuquerque.
By denying him and your wolf, you cripple not just the triad of power, but him. You have crippled him, Anita. You have crippled your master.
I heard myself say, I'm sorry.
It is not me that you must be sorry to. It is him. Go home and beg his forgiveness. Lay yourself at his feet and feed his power.
I closed my eyes, because what I really wanted to do was nod and just agree. I was pretty sure the spell would wear off before I got home to St. Louis, but putting this woman and Jean-Claude together as a team would have been my undoing. Even now, I was glad he was hundreds of miles away because I nodded, eyes still closed. She took the nod as assent.
Good. Very good. If your master is grateful for my aid in this matter, let him contact me. I know that we can come to an understanding.
And for the first time since she'd zapped me, I felt a thrill of fear. I looked at her through a veil of her power and was afraid of her. She read it in me.
You should always be afraid of gods, Anita. If you are not afraid, then you are a fool, and you are not a fool.
She looked past me to Ramirez.
I believe that I have helped you all that I can, Detective Ramirez.
He said,
Anita?
I nodded. Yeah. It's time to go see Nicky Bacco. If Nicky lied to us, then so did his pack leader. Edward said, because he said Nicky was telling the truth about not knowing where the monster was. If Nicky can share this kind of power with the werewolves, then I know why the pack lied. The werewolves will fight to protect Nicky, Edward said. We looked at each other. It'll be a bloodbath if the police go in force. I shook my head. But what choice do we have?
Nicky isn't at the bar, Ramirez said.
We turned to him, said in unison, Where is he?
In the hospital. Someone beat the shit out of him.
Edward and I exchanged glances and we both smiled. Back to the hospital then, I said. He nodded. Back to the hospital. I looked at Ramirez. If that's all right with you.
Can you prove what you've been saying about Bacco? He asked.
Yes, I said.
Then it's a death sentence. He'll know that.
I've seen Bacco in an interrogation. He's tough. And he knows that he has nothing to gain and everything to lose by telling us the truth. Then we'll have to find something that he's more afraid of than being executed. I couldn't help it. I turned and looked at Itz Papalotl. I met her eyes and there was no pull to them now. Her own power protected me from her. No stars, no endless night, just a dark knowledge of what I was thinking and her approval of the plan. We can't do anything illegal, Ramirez said. Of course not, I said.
I mean it, Anita.
I looked at him and watched him flinch when he met my eyes.
Would I do that to you?
He searched my face as if trying to decipher it. It was the way I looked at Edward sometimes, or Jean-Claude. Finally, he said,
I don't know what you'd do.
And that, for better or worse, was the truth.
Chapter 53. Edward got his sunglasses out of the glove compartment and handed them to me before we went inside the hospital. My eyes hadn't changed back, though I knew the effect was beginning to wear off, because the fact that my eyes were still black and glowy was beginning to worry me. It was a good sign. Nicky Bacco was not in a private room. The police had his roommate move to a different room. Nicky was in traction and wasn't going anywhere. He lay in the bed and looked smaller than I knew he was. The leg that had been badly broken was in a cast from toe to thigh. Little pulleys and cords held his leg up at an odd angle that must have been hell on the back. Ramirez had been questioning Nicky for about 30 minutes and was getting nowhere. Edward and I leaned against the wall and watched the show. But Nicky had done exactly what we'd feared he'd do. He'd grasped his situation and his options right away. He was going to die, so why should he help us? "We know where the monster you made is, Nicky. We know what you did. Help us stop this thing before it kills again."
"And what?" Nicky said. "I know the law. There's no life in prison for a witch that uses magic to kill. It's an automatic death sentence. You got nothing to offer me, Ramirez."
I pushed away from the wall and touched Ramirez's arm. He looked at me, and the frustration was already showing. He'd been informed that Lieutenant Marks was on the way. He wanted to crack Bacco before Marks arrived so he would get credit and not his lieutenant. Political, but the reality in most police work.
"Can I ask a few questions, Detective?"
He took a breath, let it out slow.
"Sure."
He stepped back to let me stand beside the bed. I looked down at Nicky. Someone had handcuffed one of his wrists to the bed rail. I wasn't sure it was necessary with the traction, but it made a nice point.
"What would the Red Woman's husband do if he knew you gave away his secret hideout?"
He stared up at me, and even through the sunglasses I could see the hate in his eyes. I could also see the fast rise and fall of his chest, the thud of the pulse in his neck. He was scared.
"Answer me, Nicky."
"He'd kill me."
"How?"
That made him frown.
"What do you mean, how?"
"I mean, what method of death would he use? How would he kill you?"
Nicky shifted in the bed, trying to find a comfortable spot. The leg pulled tight, and he jerked on the handcuffed wrist, making it rattle up and down the bar. There was no comfortable position for Nicky tonight.
"He'd probably send his monster after me. It'd cut me up and gut me like it's done to the others."
His minion slaughtered all the witches or psychics and skinned the mundanes. "That's it, isn't it?"
"If you're so smart, you don't need to ask me. You have all the answers."
"Not all of them," I said. I touched the bed rail that he was cuffed to, wrapped my hands around it on either side of the cuff so he couldn't slide it without hitting one of my hands.
"I've seen the bodies, Nicky. It's a bad way to go, but there are worse things."
He gave a harsh laugh.
"Being gutted alive doesn't get much worse than that," he said.
I took the sunglasses off and let him see the eyes. He stopped breathing for a heartbeat. He just stared up at me, eyes growing wide, breath trapped in his throat. I touched his hand and he screamed.
"Don't touch me! Don't you fucking touch me!"
He was jerking on the handcuff frantically over and over as if that would help. Ramirez came to stand on the other side of the bed across from me. He looked a question at me.
"I didn't hurt him, Hernando."
"Get her the fuck away from me!"
"Tell us where the monster is and I'll send her out of the room."
Nicky looked from one to the other of us, and the fear showed on his face now. You didn't have to have vampire vision to see it.
"You can't do this to me! You're the cops!"
"We're not doing anything to you," Ramirez said.
Nicky's eyes flicked back to me.
"You're the cops! You can execute me, but you can't torture me! That's the law!"
"You're right, Nicky. The police aren't allowed to torture prisoners."
I leaned in close and whispered.
"But I'm not the police."
He started tugging on the chain again, rattling it up and down the bar.
"Get her away from me, now! I want a lawyer! I want a fucking lawyer!"
Ramirez turned to the two uniformed cops waiting by the door.
"Go call Mr. Bacco a lawyer."
The two cops looked at each other.
"Both of us?"
one asked. Ramirez nodded.
"Yeah. Both of you."
They exchanged another look and went for the door. The taller one asked,
"How long you think this phone call should take?"
"A while, and knock before you come back in."
The uniforms left, and it was just Edward, Ramirez, Nicky, and me. Nicky was staring up at Ramirez.
"You're a good cop, Ramirez. I've never heard any dirt on you. You won't let her hurt me. You're a good guy. You won't let her hurt me."
His voice was high and frantic,
but each time he said it he seemed more sure of himself, more certain that Ramirez's goodness would be his shield. He was probably right on one thing. Ramirez wouldn't let me hurt him, but I was willing to bet that Ramirez would let me scare him. I reached out like I'd stroke Nikki's face. He jerked back out of reach.
Ramirez! Shit! Please, don't let her touch me!
I'll be over there if you need me, Anita. He walked away from the bed and went to sit in a chair at the end of the room near Edward. Nikki screamed after him.
Ramirez! Please! Please!
I touched his mouth with fingertips, and he froze under that gentle touch. His eyes moved slowly, so slowly until he was looking up into mine.
Shh,
I said, and lowered my face towards his, as if I'd kiss his forehead. He opened his mouth, drew a breath, and shrieked. I grabbed his face between my hands the way I'd seen Pinotl do, but I knew that it didn't have to be the hands. I could suck him dry with a kiss. Shut up, Nikki. Shut up. He started to cry.
Please. Oh, God. Please, don't.
Did the werewolves beg like this? I asked. Did they, Nikki? I pressed my hands into his face until the skin puckered.
Yes,
he said, voice squeezed by how tight I was holding his face. I had to force myself to release his face or I was going to leave red marks. Couldn't mark him up. Couldn't give marks a reason to punish Ramirez. I leaned my arms on the bed rail that he was chained to. He pulled his hand to the length of the chain, but didn't struggle. He watched me the way mice watch cats when they know there's no way out. I leaned towards him. It was a very casual movement, but it put my face close to his. Not close enough to touch, but close enough that he got an up-close look at the eyes. You see, Nikki, there are worse things.
You need me to bring the others back. You do me, and I can't give them back their lives.
You see, Nikki, I don't need you anymore. I know how to bring them back all by myself. I leaned over, balancing on tiptoe and my arms on the rail, leaning in as if to whisper in his ear. Your services are no longer needed.
Please,
he whispered. I spoke with my mouth so close to his face that I could feel my breath coming back from his skin in a warm pulse. The doctors will certify you dead, Nikki. They'll bury you in a box somewhere, and you'll hear every shovel full of dirt as it hits the coffin lid. You'll lie there in the dark and scream in your head, and no one will hear you. Maybe we'll have to put a jade bead in your mouth and sew it shut to make you lie still. Tears trailed from his eyes, but his face was blank, as if he didn't know he was crying. Tell them where your master is, Nikki, or I swear I will do worse than kill you. I kissed him on the forehead, very gently. He whimpered. I kissed the tip of his nose the way you do with children. I hovered over his mouth. Tell them, Nikki. I lowered my mouth over his. Our lips brushed, and he turned his head.
I'll tell you. I'll tell you anything you want to know.
I moved away from the bed and let Ramirez move up to take his turn. A phone rang, and Edward pulled his cell phone from his back pocket. He opened the door and went into the hall to take the call. Ramirez's voice was not happy. What do you mean you can't tell me how to get there? He had his notebook open, his pen poised, and nothing written down. I started to walk back towards the bed. Nikki held his hands up as if to ward me off.
I swear to you that I can take you to it, but I can't give you directions and be sure you'll find it. I don't want to send you out into the dark and not have you find it. You'd blame me, and it wouldn't be my fault.
Ramirez looked at me. I nodded. He was too scared to lie, and it was too stupid a story to be made up.
I can take you to it. If I'm there, I can take you to it.
Of course, if you're there, you can warn your master, I said.
I wouldn't do that.
But I saw the change in his skin color, the rise in breathing, the flick of his eyes. Liar, I said.
All right, but I'd be a fool not to try and get away. They're going to kill me, Anita. Why shouldn't I try to get away?
I guess I couldn't blame him on that one. Call Leonora Evans. She's a witch. Have her ward him, make sure that he can't contact his master by anything other than yelling.
And the yelling? Ramirez said.
Gag him when the time comes, I said. You trust Leonora Evans to do this? She saved my life, so I guess I do. Ramirez nodded.
Okay, I'll call her in.
He looked at the traction ropes. The doctors aren't going to want him going anywhere tonight. Talk to them, Hernando. Explain what's at stake. Besides, what good does it do to heal him if you're just going to turn around and execute him? Ramirez looked at me. That was harsh. Yeah, it was, but it's still true.
Edward knocked and came in the door just far enough to say, I need you out here.
I glanced at Ramirez.
I think we can take it from here.
Thank you, he said.
My pleasure.
I slipped the sunglasses back on as I followed Edward out into the hall. The moment I looked at Edward's face, I knew something bad had happened. He didn't show it the way a normal person would, but it was there. The tightness around his eyes, the way he held himself, carefully, as if he were afraid to move too suddenly or he'd break. I don't think I'd have seen it without the vampire vision.
What's wrong?
I stepped in close, because something told me this was not for police consumption. With Edward, it so seldom was. He took me by the arm down the hallway, farther away from the uniforms that were staring our way.
Riker has done us kids.
His grip tightened, and I didn't tell him it hurt.
He has Peter and Becca. He's going to kill them if I don't bring you to him now. He knows we're at the hospital. He's given me an hour to make the drive. Then he starts torturing them. If I'm not there in 2 hours, he'll kill them. If I bring the police in, he'll kill them.
I touched his arm. If it had been almost any other friend, I'd have hugged him.
Is Donna okay?
He seemed to realize he was digging into my arm and let me go.
This is Donna's night at her group. I don't know if the babysitter's still alive, but Donna won't even be home for 2, maybe 3 hours. She doesn't know.
Let's go, I said. We turned and started walking down the hallway. Ramirez yelled behind us. Where are you two going? I thought you'd want to be in on it.
Personal emergency, Edward said and kept walking.
I turned around, walking backwards, trying to talk at the same time. In 2 hours, call Ted's house. The call will be forwarded to his cell phone. We'll join you on the monster hunt.
Why 2 hours? He asked.
The emergency will be taken care of by then, I said. I had to touch Edward's arm to keep walking backwards and not fall.
Everything could be over 2 hours from now, Ramirez said.
I'm sorry.
Edward was at the doors that led into the next section of hallway. He pulled me through. The doors shut behind us. He was already punching numbers on the cell phone.
I'll have Olaf and Bernardo meet us at the turnoff to Riker's place.
I don't know which of them answered, but he gave a long list of things to bring, and he made them write it down. We were out of the hospital, through the parking lot and getting into his Hummer before he clicked the telephone off. Edward drove, and all I had to do was think. Not a good thing. I was remembering last May when some bad guys kidnapped Richard's mother and younger brother. They'd sent us a box with a lock of his brother's hair and his mother's finger in it. Everyone that had touched them was dead. Everyone that had hurt them would never hurt anyone again. I only had 2 regrets. 1, that I hadn't gotten there in time to save them from being tortured. 2, that the bad guys hadn't suffered enough before they died. If Riker hurt Peter and Becca, I wasn't sure I wanted to see what Edward would do to him. I prayed as we rode through the darkness. Please, God, don't let them be hurt. Let them be safe. Riker could be lying. They could already be dead, but I didn't think so. Maybe because I needed them to be alive. I remembered Becca in her sunflower dress with that sprig of lilacs in her hair, laughing in Edward's arms. I saw Peter's sullen resentment when Edward and his mother touched. I remembered the way Peter had stood up to Russell in the restaurant when he threatened Becca. He was a brave kid. I tried not to think about what could be happening to them right this second. Edward had gone very, very quiet. When I looked at him, the dark crystal vision showed me further into him than I'd ever seen before. I didn't have to guess whether he cared for the children. I could see it. He loved them. As much as he was capable of it, he loved them. If someone hurt them, his vengeance was going to be a thing of great and awesome terror. I wouldn't be able to stop him no matter what he wanted to do to them. All I would be able to do was stand and watch and try not to get too much blood on my shoes.
Chapter 54.
It was a dark night. It didn't seem to be cloudy, just dark, as if something besides clouds was blocking the moon. Or maybe that was just my frame of mind. The one thing I'd wanted to avoid while I was doing my favor for Edward was dealing with Edward at his most illegal. We'd picked up Olaf and Bernardo at a crossroads in the middle of nowhere, with those empty rolling hills stretching out and out into the darkness. There had been no cover except some scrub bushes, and when Edward stopped the car and cut the engine, I thought we'd have a wait ahead of us.
Get out, We'll need to suit up.
He'd gotten out without waiting to see if I was getting out or not. I got out. The silence seemed as big as the sky overhead, an immense emptiness. A man stood up not 5 feet in front of me. I had the Browning pointed before the man held a flashlight under his face, and I realized it was Bernardo. Olaf had magically appeared on the other side of the road. There was no ditch on either side of the road. There was nothing on the side of the road. What was even more impressive was that they began lifting large black bags of equipment out of that same nowhere. If we'd had the time, I'd have asked how they did it, though I doubt I'd have understood the answer. Training, probably. Training I didn't have, though it might be nice to get it. Of course, most of the things I hid from could have heard Bernardo's and Olaf's heartbeat no matter how well hidden they were. It was almost a relief to be up against mere humans. It meant you could at least hide in the dark. 20 minutes later, we were on the road again, and Edward hadn't been joking on the suiting up part. I'd had to strip to my bra and put on a Kevlar vest. It was my size. Which meant it had to be a special purchase, because Kevlar doesn't come in my size off the rack.
"It's your prize for spotting all the weapons," Edward said.
He always knows just what to buy me. I needed to adjust the shoulder holster after putting on the vest, but I was told to do it in the car. I didn't argue. We had less than 10 minutes to get to Riker's place. My t-shirt didn't quite fit over the body armor. I mean, it did fit, but not well. Bernardo handed me a black long-sleeved man's shirt.
"Put it on over the t-shirt. Button it part way after you've got your holsters adjusted."
The shoulder holster was just a matter of readjusting straps. The inner pants holster just didn't work once the vest was on. I put the Firestar down the front of my jeans and angled it until I was as happy as I was going to get with the way it fit. It still dug into my stomach, but I wanted it where I could get it fast. I could live with bruises tomorrow. I practiced drawing the Browning through the half-open shirt a few times, though it's hard to practice drawing from a sitting position, but we didn't have time for me to get out and practice standing. "You guys are making me nervous, putting me in Kevlar."
"You didn't argue," Bernardo said.
"We don't have time to argue. Tell me what to do, I'll do it. But why the Kevlar?"
"Olaf,"
Edward said.
"Riker employs 20 men. 10 are just hired muscle. We've met half of them already. But he's got 10s that he keeps close to him. 3 ex-SEALs, 2 ex-Army Rangers, 1 ex-Police, and 4 guys who have black files. Which meant whatever they do or did, it's top secret, and maybe rogue."
I remembered what FBI agent Bradford had said about Olaf, that he had a black file. Isn't this a little too commando raidish for a pot hunter? Olaf continued like I hadn't said anything. Bernardo started showing me the contents of a large leather purse at the same time. I listened to Olaf and watched Bernardo.
"Riker has connections in South America that supply him with contraband. Suspicions are that he's running more than just artifacts. Maybe drugs. The locals have no idea how big a bad guy they've got here."
"When did you find all this out?"
"After they came to the house," Edward said.
"How did you find all this out?" I asked.
"If we told you, we'd have to kill you," Olaf said.
I started to smile, thinking it was a joke, but I caught a glimpse of his face as the only car we'd seen passed by, flashing lights over us as it passed. He didn't look like he was joking. Bernardo said,
"This looks like a can of hairspray. You can even squirt out a small amount of Cresol,"
he demonstrated.
"But lift here."
He did, and revealed a second layer of metal.
"This is the pin. This is the depressor. It's an incendiary grenade. You pull the pin, let up on the depressor, and you have 3 seconds to get a minimum of 50 feet away from it. It's got white phosphorus in it. This shit burns underwater. If you get a tiny piece on your sleeve, it will eat through the cloth, your skin, bone, all the way to the other side."
He clicked the secret compartment shut and handed it to me. "Damned heavy for hairspray," I said.
"Yeah, but how many ex-Navy whatevers are going to notice?"
He had a point. Next was a small thing of breath freshener that was really heavy-duty mace. A keyring that when you hit the button on it, a 4-inch blade popped out. There was a heavy ink pen that actually wrote, that if you pressed the little switch, a 6-inch blade came out the end. There was real perfume with a higher-than-normal alcohol content. "Go for the eyes," was the advice. A disposable lighter, because you never know when you might need some fire, and a package of cigarettes to explain the lighter. There was a transmitter in the collar of the black shirt that would allow them to find me inside the buildings, or at least find the shirt. I was beginning to feel like I'd been shanghaied into a James Bond movie. I lifted out a hairbrush with a heavier-than-normal handle. What's this?